Yeah. Again, a very high concentration of blood vessels, right? A high concentration of neurons in the tongue. Over the course of human history, the tongue has always been one of our primary compass points for what to eat. If you look at the taste buds on the surface of the tongue, they help guide us. Sweet, it's always at the back of the tongue, right? Sweet foods are almost always immediately safe, not maybe with chronic consumption, but you won't eat honey, of course, and be sick, right? Whereas there are substances in plants that we have a very, very, at the front of our tongue, we have this concentration of taste buds, whoa, right? Bit, you know, if it's a certain type of bitterness, it can be toxic. So there's a high concentration of neurons and blood vessels in the tongue. So your observations of the iguana make total sense. It's great. Yeah. They do. Absolutely. In Chinese medicine, the tongue is a primary point of assessment or investigation. Absolutely. Yes, it does. Yes, it does. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, so her mother died of malignant melanoma. She's had a malignant melanoma removed. And you're asking, so I can still go out in the sun? And I'm saying, absolutely. Yeah.
Doesn't make sense, right? Most melanomas occur in non-sun exposed areas of the skin.
Highest incidence is among smokers. Smokers in areas of the body with no sun exposure. Yeah. Yeah. Well, with that said, I'm going to shift gears now from a different aspect of nourishment to one that's equally important, and that is the importance of energy. Being nourished with energy from the earth, from water, from plants. This is a increasingly interesting, developing area of science, and it's called the acquisition of electrons in scientific terms. You all know what electrons are? That's the primary currency of energy. So everything has electrons in the outer orbital, right? That's what gives certain molecules a charge. This is how batteries work. This is how electricity works. It's all about electrons. The Earth's surface is an enormous source of electrons. You have to acquire electrons regularly so that your tissues can maintain a certain amount of repulsion force. Now, this is often referred to in the area of physics as a zeta potential. Zeta, Z-E-T-A. The zeta potential describes the strength of repulsion between two molecules. In this case, we could, for simplicity, discuss the charge that you hopefully have on your artery walls or maybe your capillary walls. So you know your capillaries are, right? In the body, blood, right, leaves the heart and the aorta and then immediately starts to branch out, right? Into arterioles and then capillaries, which ultimately deliver the oxygen and the nutrients to the working muscles and the tissues that need it. And then it comes back, right, in venules, veins, and then the superior and inferior vena cava. So that's our circulatory system. All along the way in that entire circulatory system, miles and miles of blood vessels, both arteries and veins, we have these amazing membranes with which blood flows. All of those membranes have this negative charge. We hope, okay? Because flowing in all of those blood vessels, we have a variety of molecules, right? We have red blood cells that carry oxygen. We have white blood cells, again, a key component to our immune system. And we have lipoproteins, right? Low density lipoproteins that people refer to as the bad cholesterol, high density lipoproteins, triglycerides. You're familiar with all of this, right? And this milieu is always flowing through our blood vessels. And we hope it's flowing very freely. We hope that it's flowing easily and that we don't have sluggish circulation. Is everybody with me? So most people are under the assumption that you have sluggish circulation, you're in need of a blood thinner, right? You maybe need to drink more water, and that could be true. Maybe you eat more turmeric, take more ginger. You know, there's a long list of things that can influence these, what we call hemodynamics. One of the most influential is the zeta potential, which is having strong repulsion between these negatively charged molecules in our blood and the tissue or the membrane that lines the blood vessel. You want these two to repel each other, which negative and a negative charge will do. But what happens when we start to lose that electron influx into the body and our tissues start to become more positively charged? Now we have less repulsion, a weak zeta potential, and now you start to have almost an attraction. Is everybody understanding this? A little bit. Well, the bottom line is if you spend time barefoot in contact with the earth's surface, not with a floor in a building that's insulated and again, separated from nature, separated from earth, from Terra Madre, right? You have to be in direct contact with Mother Earth or the oceans, the rivers. There's some really good evidence with trees and plants as well. Slightly different. You pick up this negative influx of electrons and it maintains a stronger zeta potential. And they've done some really mind-bending research, taking a person, putting their feet in the sand and measuring their blood pressure, and seeing that the zeta potential can drop a person's blood pressure significantly within a few minutes. Now, if you start to put all of these pieces of the puzzle together, which is what makes me so passionate and optimistic in terms of helping people understand how they can really turn their health around. Let's say now you start to spend some time barefoot in a river, or even if you don't have access, you go out in the park with wet grass and spend time with your feet in the wet grass, which is an amazing conductor because basically water really accelerates the conduction of these electrons into our body. You couple that with sunlight, more love in your life, more smiling and laughing, and then the foods that you can incorporate. I mean, I think that the potential for humans to turn their health around, it's so astounding every time I see it happen. Yeah. In my garden, I spend my whole time's on my knees, right? And I feel so content, so peaceful, right? And I think it's a combination of things, the sun, the grounding. I love working with plants. You know, that in itself is a very powerful communion. So absolutely. So this is called earthing or grounding. And again, it's a very, very important component of nourishment. And if you live in a high rise in a city and you say, well, I just don't have time to get outside, I would want to make a strong argument for you having the time in your life to get outside. But I know people now that, and again, I don't think this is the best solution, but for many people, they see it as maybe a short-term solution. There are these things you can buy that plug into your outlet. And as long as your outlet has a ground, which is the round plug, right? You know that there's the two that look like they're very linear slots, that and that's an ungrounded if it only has those two. But if it has a round plug, the third component, that is a ground. And there are these devices now that people are sleeping on. They're called earthing mats, or that they're just putting their feet on. Again, I think it's kind of like when we talk about using a light box versus the sun. It's kind of an alternative if you don't have sunlight, and this is an alternative if you don't have a place that is nature that you can get out and go barefoot in. Any questions on this? The earthing mat is grounded through your building into a ground somewhere outside of the building. That's why it prevents short circuiting of certain devices, and it can be used for grounding. Yes. Yeah. Great. Yeah, well, plastic, wood are the primary insulators. Not good at conducting. Rubber is an insulator. Glass, copper, steel, highly conducive. Water is the best. So putting your feet in any body of water, even a swimming pool, believe it or not. A swimming pool is a source of electrons because somewhere that swimming pool is going to be in contact with the Earth's surface, whether it's through its drainage, its water source. But water, glass, steel, copper is among the best, silver. But you really, if you spend time in most buildings, you're going to be insulated by styrofoam, plastic, wood, something along those lines. So that's what you're you know, trying to get more in the area of glass, metal, water. Cement is a source of conductivity, but it depends on the constitution of the cement. Some cements are very porous and have lots of air in them, and they're very light, and those aren't good. And some concretes are very dense and have a massive amount of rock and stone in them, and they're much better. You're walking in high heel? Freestyle shoes, yeah, zero heels. Crystal heels. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, I don't. I can't answer about crystal heels. But I know. Okay. Yeah. I. They probably exist. That's why. Yeah. Right. There are these shoes now that are strictly leather. I have a totally leather heel. I just can't say how conducive that is because it may have, yeah, yeah. There are earthing shoes that people wear, but I just don't know, Carla, so I can't answer how conducive they are. Barefoot is the gold standard. And then, yeah, once you leave that, it's for me, it's an unknown. I just don't know. Yeah. And that's beautiful that you brought that up. So in Japan, there's a concept called forest bathing or bathing in the trees, which is where, again, you pick up an array of things, only I think of which a few have been quantified, right? But and this takes us into the area of quantum physics. How much of this nourishment goes way beyond the food that we eat and is on an energetic level? And I think that that's the next dimension, right? Is how do we become more nourished not only by spending time in a forest, petting our dog, hugging a loved one, but you know, you start to think about all the other components, like the way a food is raised, the way it's prepared. I think that is a very underappreciated component of nourishment, is all that goes into the way a meal or a dish is prepared. That is going to influence how it either nourishes us or does not nourish us. So forest bathing is phenomenal. Yeah. Natural killer cells, sure, right? Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And there have been various parameters that have been used to assess the health effects of this forest bathing.
But that's different from walking.
It is different, yeah. It's different, but it's the same. You're picking up energy that is being produced by trees and plants, but not necessarily electrons, right. Thanks. Yeah.
I live in a building in Mexico City, and my apartment
Uh-huh.
But on the basement is a parking lot.
Okay. Sure.
Okay. So I have a terrace covered by a very typical stone from Mexico. It's a cantera. Natural stone.
Okay. Yes. Uh-huh. It's possible. It all depends on what those stones are connected to. If the stones that cover your terrace and you're barefoot on them are connected by steel to the earth, then yes. But I don't know that. Because some buildings, especially high rises, are insulated from the ground with various, what they call electronic breaks, so that currents can't, you know, make it into your building or out of your building. So I can't answer that, but if you knew that those stones covering your terrace were in fact in contact through steel, girders, rebar with the earth, you would be able to ground through that.
Okay, and that terrace is surrounded
by plants. That's beautiful, yeah. Okay. Well, are those plants growing in containers, or are their roots going down into the earth?
Yes.
They're going down into the earth? I'm sorry, I just, without a blueprint of your building, it'd be very difficult to, I just don't know what's connected. Yeah. So, it sounds possible. It sounds as though that it's possible. That's it. It's interesting that we've got a few things that people are, you know, questioning, and it makes us really take a look at our place in the ecosystem, doesn't it? Yeah. Okay, well, now I want to, if I can, shift gears into the, I guess, the more literal translation of nourishment in today's world, which is nutrients, right? And the acquisition of nutrients from plants and animals and from the soil. And it really all starts with our soil. So people always say to me, how can you say we're more malnourished now than we were 100 years ago? To Mark's point, people are living longer. Isn't that evidence that we're healthier now? And, you know, if you take a look at the fossil record, and anthropology is a field that I have just so much interest in, because I think anthropology tells us our story. It also shows us retrospectively, you know, how humans lived for thousands and thousands of years, and more often than not, they lived in much greater harmony with their ecosystem. And it's not to say that things were always wonderful. There were famines. Of course, there are wars, and there still are wars. And humans haven't always been at peace with their ecosystem and have had, you know, problems, you know, basically accommodating other lives. But the bottom line is indigenous populations, and still to this day, had a much greater ability to learn how plants and animals could nourish them, then they would want to put all of that aside and take all of these isolated supplements and, you know, run from that which nourished them and which their elders would, you know, share as observations. This is really how you can thrive in this environment. And so much of that has been lost or been overridden, as we've already discussed. So malnourishment has taken place for several reasons. Number one is, and maybe foremost, we've lost our ancestral ways. We've left the liver and the organs behind in an effort to just eat steak. We've lost the value of eating the roots of plants and eating the stalks of plants, which are so nourishing, in an effort to only eat one component of a plant, which is either the sweetest or has the
which we find most palatable. Those are examples of food choices that are different. Many of us now eat foods which are raised in soils that have become very depleted, right? I mean, we have, covering the surface of this planet, we have about 3 to 4 inches of topsoil, and it only covers about 1/33 of the Earth's surfaces. So you remove oceans and deserts and parking lots and housing developments, and now you only have 1/33 of the Earth's surface with which can support humanity. And that's being lost rapidly because of chemicals. In China, for instance, over 35% of the soils in China now have such high heavy metal burdens that they can't grow food anymore. And you, the ramifications for that, again, for the global community are very dire. Truly the solution for all of us and for the Gaia model is to try to resuscitate our soils. And that's going to be chemical-free. It's going to be using plant and animal manure to revitalize the soil, to bring microbes back into the soil, much in the same way that we have to revitalize our intestinal tracts. Most people are malnourished from the macro level, which is we don't eat enough food. The average person, and I would say this is not only true in the United States, I would say this is true from my time in other areas of Central America, South America, most people don't eat enough food. The only populations that I've seen eat enough food are the indigenous populations. And again, this is well documented. Populations that are eating the roots of plants, the stalks of plants, and eating various aspects of animal protein, they eat typically 500 more calories per day than the average American. But yet doctors still tell people in America, you eat too much, too many calories. No. Calories is very misleading. People eat too many calories from the wrong foods. They don't eat enough calories from certain plants, from certain aspects of animal protein. So we don't eat enough. We eat foods that are grown in soils that are depleted, right? We eat plants that have been developed for sweetness, long shelf lives. They resist bruising when they're being transported from California to New York or, you know, from, you know, areas of, you know, Central America to the United States. So we have the wrong cultivars. We have soil that's depleted. We don't eat enough nutrient-dense foods to begin with. And then we have that other source of malnourishment, which is we have dysbiosis in our microbiome. We all have 5 pounds, give or take a pound, of bacteria in our large intestine and sometimes in our small intestine. And that 4 to 5 pounds of bacteria and other life forms enable us to either acquire nutrients from foods or to miss out on nutrients and to suffer certain amounts of malabsorption. And if you have dysbiosis, you have the wrong families of bacteria which are overrepresented, much like a cow that's on antibiotics. The cow that's on antibiotics will not acquire all of the short-chain fatty acids from the hay or the grass in their diet. Those cows have to be revitalized. Luckily, in the United States, if a farmer brings a cow to a veterinarian and says, my cow's not growing, the veterinarian, with not being a functional veterinarian, not having to go to a special school like a physician may have to become a functional physician, or to retrain themselves, most veterinarians will say to the farmer, so tell me, what are the symptoms of this cow? What has this cow been eating? Have you been giving your cow too many antibiotics? And if the farmer says, yes, I have, then the veterinarian will say, well, you know, the cow needs to regain its microbiome. The cow needs to go back out in the pasture, and it needs to have exposure to the microbes that are in the rumens of the other cows, and it will slowly acquire those and will get back its health. But, you know, this doesn't happen. Most people in the United States, and I'm going to say this is true throughout the kind of Western hemisphere, most people have some form of dysbiosis, yet they're never taught how they can reacquire the beneficial microbes that will again help them be nourished. So malnourishment takes place for a lot of different reasons, but most people are malnourished, and we're going to start this week helping you identify foods that really nourish human physiology. And it's, you know, it's sometimes, again, we've talked about sunlight. We'll talk extensively more about cholesterol. These are things that for people to hear them the first time, it's a revelation to hear that I should go out in the sun, Maybe be barefoot on wet grass. Don't take a statin, but actually welcome higher cholesterol levels. The same is true when it comes with what we should eat. When it comes to what we should eat, it's also radically different for people to hear, yeah, eat eggs every day. Eat liver once a week. The liver from whether it's a cow or a lamb. These are really different messages to hear for the first time. So I don't expect it to become gospel. I think it's something that I want to present to you so that you can start to digest it and start to see if it feels good to you on some level intuitively. But I think it's just really important to, and so many people shared it last night in terms of being open and being ready for this information. I have what I call plant toxicology that I want to go through with you. And it's very fun, and it helps identify why it is certain plant foods are very toxic to the human body. And why, you know, certain animal foods can also be toxic. It's not to say that animal foods, we've already talked a little bit about dairy products. You know, the milk from a Holstein cow that is then pasteurized and homogenized is terrible. Much like a certain type of plant food would be if it were using certain cultivars of a plant. Again, I have very strong convictions around wheat. I think wheat is the worst thing in terms of a common plant food. Wheat is the worst. And I could, you know, go on and on at great length about why it is nobody in this room should eat wheat. But if you were going to eat wheat, I would help you identify the best sources of wheat. They would typically be grown, you know, somewhere in Europe where it would be a very old cultivar. You could find them. You could probably even have them shipped to you here. But the types and varieties of wheat that are grown commercially now are very toxic to human physiology. Now, that's like in the area of grains, that's the worst of the worst. Wheat is the worst. Nobody should eat wheat. But at the other end of the spectrum, I could make a strong argument that many of you would do remarkably well with rice, eaten every day. Rice is so much more compatible with human physiology than wheat is. You can't even begin to compare them. And the best rice is white rice. Basmati white rice is the best. And I, when it traveling through Asia, when I was in my 20s and I was stuck in dogma, why aren't you eating brown rice? I would say to these people, and they would say to me, nobody eats brown rice. And I'd say, but that's impossible. And I would return to the United States and I would speak with fellow graduate students or maybe some of my professors and graduate. I said, you know, it's amazing. I spent time with these people in Nepal or Tibet and or Thailand, and they all ate white rice. And they say, yeah, but you know, they didn't eat very much of it. I said, no, they ate quite a bit. They said, well, they ate it with a lot of vegetables, a lot of bok choy. And I said, well, I don't know. And the more and more I learned as I just continued to pursue this, I realized that white rice is, out of all the grain and cereal products, it has the least amount of anti-nutrients, the least amount of plant toxins, in a grain. And so, but again, these populations, they would try to share with me and break through my dogma. They'd say, listen, hundreds of years ago, our ancestors observed what happened in those villages that didn't want to take the time to remove the bran from the rice. Their children didn't grow. We saw protein malnutrition. They had other words for it. We saw trace mineral malabsorption in those children in the villages where they just ate the rice after it came out of the field. They said to really make rice compatible with a human digestive system, you have to get the bran off of the rice. And you know what I understand now about bran? It's, to me, it's very clear. Bran causes damage to the intestinal environment. We, in the United States, people still eat cereals that are fortified with bran. They take wheat bran and put it in products called All Bran and Raisin Bran. And people are bombarding their guts with bran. And they're told good things like, if you eat a bran-rich cereal, it'll have a lower glycemic index. It won't raise your blood sugar levels. It'll help you have several bowel movements a day. It's what everybody should have, a bran-rich cereal to start the day. One of the reasons it's causing people to have several bowel movements is causing mechanical damage to the intestinal wall. Bran is the primary defense mechanisms of cereal grains to prevent ruminants from absorbing anything from that grain. The plant has evolved to defend itself against grazers, things that would wipe out a whole pasture full of wheat. The wheat plant has devised mechanisms with which, if an animal goes in there and starts to overgraze on that wheat, the animal is going to eliminate that through its digestive tract so rapidly that the seeds are spread through the environment, and even better yet, they're fertilized with a very loose bowel movement from that ruminant. So we don't even have the microbes that these animals do, so it affects us in a more adverse mechanism. So with that, we've covered a little bit of territory since our last chance to ask questions. I'd love to hear what your questions are about this so far. Donna. Yeah. White rice is better than brown rice. Yeah, yeah. So you don't even have to refrigerate it. You just have to let it cool to room temperature. And that allows the starch, which when it's hot, white rice, the same is true of a white potato. Doesn't happen overnight. No, I think the study done, a really, really cool study was done in Sri Lanka. They took white rice, boiled it, of course. It was very hot. Mixed 2 tablespoons of coconut oil with it. And then put it in a refrigerator, and in 2 hours, it was all retrograded starch. And at that point in time, only 30% of the calories in that white rice could actually be absorbed into circulation by the body. The other 70% of the calories had to be metabolized by the microbes in the GI, and it only fed the microbes, which is fascinating. So that's called retrograded or resistant starch. You don't have to refrigerate it, though. You just have to let it cool to room temperature, and then you'll have a significant increase. So, so my point is, when you eat a white potato or white rice, and, you know, truthfully, you could say this about a lot of very starchy, you know, yuca is an amazing food when eaten as a leftover, okay? Yuca. So you don't eat it hot. You let it cool. Don't heat it again. You can only heat, you can't heat it again. You can't take white rice, let it cool, and then put it back in hot water, because then it breaks down even more so than it was at the beginning. And what happens is, when a starchy root vegetable or something like rice is hot and it's been boiled or steamed, all of the carbohydrate polymers or chains break down into little pieces that you can absorb rapidly into your bloodstream. Is everybody with me? But when you let those glucose or chains of sugar, when you let them cool, they come back together like a very dense ball of yarn. Those don't enter your bloodstream now. That's called resistant starch. And the only thing that those starches are going to feed are the microbes in your intestinal tract. And many of these resistant starches can produce favorable shifts in a person's ecosystem, in their digestive tract. It's not a one-size-fits-all. There are people that I do not recommend eating white rice, white potato, yuca, or resistant starches, so it isn't a one-size-fits-all, but for many people, white rice, white potatoes, sweet potatoes, yuca, these are good things to eat. These are what I call safe starches that They don't contain anti-nutrients. As long as the yuca is properly soaked and cooked, you would never want to eat raw yuca or undercooked yuca because it contains cyanide. You would never want to eat a white potato that was growing with exposure to the sun because it will contain high levels of solanine, which is very irritating to the digestive lining. And, you know, so there's these caveats with most plant foods. But by and large, resistant starch is like a safe starch. It's a good source of carbohydrates if your diet accommodates more carbohydrates. This is, I think, very important for young children to have starch in their diet. And it can be very important for many people to have a healthier digestive tract, to have some of this resistant starch. So that's where resistant starch comes in white basmati rice that's allowed to cool is the type of rice that will have the highest amount of resistant starch. But it wouldn't be more resistant starch than you'd get in something like the Jerusalem artichoke or, you know, yuca that's allowed to cool. So typically your starchy root vegetables are better sources of resistant starch than any grain. But that being said, I was just using rice as an example of something that is so much better than wheat if someone chooses to have a grain. That doesn't have to happen. That's a traditional Sri Lankan way of cooking rice. I don't. You don't have to, but it's an option and it's a good option because you know, the coconut oil has some amazing attributes, and it does seem to enhance at least somewhat some of that resistant starch formation. Yeah, oats. You know, oats are not so good. They're not as bad as wheat. I would say oats are somewhere between rice and wheat. Oats contain a type of gluten. It's called avenin. So in Latin, oats are called avena sativa. Okay, so avenin is the type of gluten found in oats. Now, avenin does not appear to be as damaging as gliadin, but it is still at least a mild irritant to the digestive tract. I think oats, the best way to make oats would be you would let the oats soak overnight and maybe even ferment. Fermentation of oats, barley, even wheat really helps clean up the anti-nutrients. So I would say oats are somewhere in between wheat and rice. Not as good as rice, but not as bad as wheat. Her question is about oats and cholesterol. Oats will help lower your cholesterol. Here's the mechanism. Bile is secreted by your gallbladder into your digestive tract. Oats contain a substance called beta-D-glucan. When you have oatmeal and you have bile from your gallbladder in the digestive tract at the same time, the beta-D-glucan in the fiber of those oats binds onto the bile acids and eliminates that from your body. Now, because bile is about 90% cholesterol, you lose all of that cholesterol when you have a bowel movement and the bile is carried out by the oats. Is that good? I don't, maybe. But if that's the reason you're eating oats, I don't know if that's a good enough reason. You would do much better if your goal was to eliminate cholesterol in the form of bile, you'd do much better eating beets. Beets have more beta-D-glucan, far more nutrients such as potassium. Beets are an amazing vegetable. And people run from beets because they hear the sugar. I would really challenge someone, have one or two beets thrown in a Vitamix or a blender, drink it as a juice. You get so many benefits from that, as opposed to a bowl of oatmeal, where the carbohydrate density of those oats are like 80% carbohydrate by weight. That's not true with beets. Beets are only about 10% carbohydrate by weight. Yeah, they have some sugar in them, but I'll take that sugar with all the good things I get in beets. Now, again, oatmeal is going to lower your cholesterol a little bit, but it's also going to raise your insulin levels, right? And insulin is if there's one hormone I want you all to have tested at some point, and I think, Mark, you'd probably feel the same way. You want to learn more about your fasting insulin levels. That tells you, in a fasting state, of course, so it has some limitations, but your fasting insulin levels are going to tell you a lot about your body's metabolic profile. And you want your fasting insulin levels to be lower. Eating things like oats every day in an effort to lower cholesterol levels is somewhat ineffective because you're going to lose bile. And then I know there's some upsides to losing bile because you can lose toxins when you lose bile. It's a good way to eliminate some toxins, not all. But oats, especially, you know, eating a significant bowl of oatmeal, it's going to raise your insulin levels because of its carbohydrate density. And it can feed the wrong families of bacteria. You know, the beets feed good families of bacteria. Carrots feed really good families of bacteria, but oats not so much. So I'd much rather see you make a smoothie in the morning made with a whole lemon, where you put the whole lemon in, peel and all, two big raw beets, and an avocado, and drink that. And then I want you to get back to me with respect to changes, right? But oats do lower cholesterol levels a little bit, but it's not, for me, it's not worth the sacrifices you'll make. Yeah.
So I take it from what you said, there are certain things that are really bad, like wheat.
Yeah.
And then you're not saying rice is good, really, even resistant, there's better stuff. But one thing that's really helpful to me is to hear like what is really good and what we really should eat and can eat, because a lot of the rhetoric out there is all, if you don't do this,
yeah. Yeah, so... Okay, Marianne's question is a really good one. She's heard what I've had to say about wheat and that, you know, foods like rice, and I would put buckwheat in the same... Buckwheat is not related to wheat. Buckwheat is a member of the vegetable family. It's a whole different plant. You know, so she's heard what I've had to say about wheat as being something I feel everybody should avoid. And then I've said that rice may be an option. It might not be ideal for everybody. And it's not a very nutrient-dense food. White rice doesn't really give us much in the way of nutrients. It feeds the microbiome. And I think it's can be a great part of a person's food culture without really causing that much damage, which is very different than how I feel about wheat. But Marianne said, you know, are there some foods that we should always avoid and some foods that we should try to include most often? And this is an important part of the ongoing dialogue we're having around nourishment. I said at the beginning of this talk this morning, there's some words I really cringe when I hear. And one of those is, and it's common, is don't eat too much. And I meet a lot of people who are really into fasting for extended periods of time, intermittent fasting with very little limited intakes of food. And I always want people to understand there's therapeutic value to that. But first and foremost, we have to be nourished. You have to acquire nutrients from your diet. And we have not identified all of the essential nutrients required by the human body. This is really important. People tend to think that we've got it all nailed down, right? Vitamin C, vitamin K2, you know, it doesn't work like that. There are a lot of nutrients out there essential to optimal health that just aren't household words and aren't in supplement form yet. And so I think you have to eat foods. You have to eat enough food to acquire all of the nutrients that you need to be strong. And so, with that in mind, I like intermittent fasting. I like fasting for therapeutic purposes. I think a ketogenic diet is incredibly restorative and can help people effectively fight numerous diseases and conditions. But I don't want anyone to fast or even be in intermittent fasting at the cost of nourishment. Does that make sense to everyone? And it's a tough thing because we live in a very monolithic society now. People hear one thing and they say, well, I got to fast. You know, I got to fast. I'm not going to have anything for breakfast. And I'm only going to eat, you know, a 5 or 6 hour window during the day. And yet, you know, I've met people who do this and they have sarcopenia. They can't maintain muscle mass because they're having a small salad for lunch and then they're having some steamed vegetables for dinner with, you know, like 1 or 2 ounces of protein. Look, if you're losing muscle mass to the point where you can't hike and you can't do the things that you want to do and you don't have an active life, then I don't know, is it worth it? So it isn't one size fits all, but nourishment is for everybody. And the foods that truly nourish us are going to be, so this is to Marianne's question, are going to be the following foods. These are, like, I don't think anybody should eat wheat. These are foods I think everybody should eat. And I promise I can find one that you will like if you give me time. Dark green leafy vegetables. And I encourage people to branch out from kale and broccoli and spinach and to try things such as dandelion greens, arugula, endive, tatsoi. You know, many people eat day in and day out very common, what I call vanilla greens. These are green leafy vegetables they've heard good things about, or that maybe don't have much flavor, and that's working for their children because their children have some type of a resistance to eating like arugula or something that's more bitter. And I kind of understand that, but I think people really need to branch out and have small dark greens that are grown in soil, not hydroponically. You know, I think we have a lot of mesculine mix on salad bars and on plates throughout North America. I'm not sure if that's the same here in Central America, but mesculine mixes are often grown in soilless mediums where the plants never take up micronutrients from rich soil. You really want your greens to be grown in the soil, not in water where fertilizers are added. Even if they're organic, it's a big fight going on now in states like Vermont and in throughout the United States is that the organic certification, there's a movement through the federal government, of course, where these big hydroponic farms want their vegetables to be certified organic. And that shouldn't be the case. I think plants have to be grown in soil with a wide variety of micronutrients. That's the only way we're going to be nourished from eating those foods. But dark green leafy vegetables are, in my opinion, the foundation of most meals. Most. Maybe one meal a day you don't have dark greens and you have some other type of vegetable, either a starchy root vegetable or berries. But, you know, 2 of your 3 meals should be very rich in these dark greens, which present to us the most important. If we go strictly on how much of a particular nutrient we need a day, you know, most of us need 4,000 to 5,000 milligrams of potassium per day. If you don't get that, you might start to create an imbalance where your body retains fluid. And so if we go strictly on a macro perspective, like what is it we need the most of? Of course, water, right? And after that, we need typically, in terms of a micronutrient, we need the most potassium. And the richest sources of potassium on the planet are dark green leafy vegetables. Dandelion greens, spinach, Swiss chard, all examples of very, very potassium-rich vegetables. And if you don't get those consistently, your body will start to break down in one way or another. Most people accept muscle atrophy as a normal part of aging. And research at the Tufts Center on Aging in Boston has shown those people at the greatest risk for sarcopenia, muscle atrophy as they get older, are people who have a couple different things in place. One is they don't eat enough potassium. Number two is they don't eat enough protein. And often those things are happening simultaneously. And number three is populations eating large amounts of grain, which present a metabolic acid load to their physiology. And that also tends to deteriorate muscle mass. So there's three factors that the Tufts Center on Aging has identified as being risk factors for muscle loss as we get older. A grain-centric diet, you know, eating box cereals or hot cereals in the morning, having sandwiches made up of bread for lunch, and then eating pasta or more grain for dinner. Very common throughout much of, you know, the Western Hemisphere and the rest of the world for that matter. Not enough potassium, not enough protein in the diet. This is the perfect storm right now, and that's why sarcopenia, it's very prevalent in North America.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she lays it out, right? And you're like, am I eating all this in a day?
Yeah.
So two cool, really cool tricks. I started doing this summer. Go get, you know, put this big salad together, right? And you're still like, am I a baby elephant? How am I eating all this? But you take these scissors.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. Beautiful. Yeah. I always encourage people to envision a plate or a bowl. And for me, it's a large bowl. And you want to make at least 2/3, maybe 3/4 of that vegetables. It doesn't have to be all green leafy vegetables. Sweet potatoes, carrots. Again, we've talked about beets, radishes, cucumbers. This really all counts as part of that volume that you're picturing. And then the other, you know, 25 to a third of that is made up of different things. Maybe some of that's rice, for those of you who want to have rice. Maybe some of that's meat or eggs. But green leafy vegetables, for me, that's like the foundation. Now, of course, if you just, you can't live on salads alone, right? You need to have other sources of other nutrients, which we're going to get to this week. And usually, in my opinion, they're carried by fat-rich foods. Nuts and seeds, coconut, fatty cuts of meat, eggs, oily fish if you choose to eat fish, you know, cheese made, again, from the right animal, raw milk we've talked about, which is at least 50% fat. So I always emphasize fiber from green leafy vegetables and fat together as being major components or foundations of what I think is the most compatible human diet. Very compatible with not only human physiology, but again, across the board with mammalian physiology. And then the next chapter that we'll get into after talking about nourishment is that of toxicology. You know, why is it, you know, we want to make sure that certain vegetables are always cooked, or that we, you know, try to avoid more of the, and we'll get into wheat in greater detail, and I'll help explain to you why it is wheat is so toxic. You know, why is it that wheat causes food allergies? You know, so many people I've met with over the years have these allergies to eggs. Yet when they go gluten-free 3 months later, they tolerate eggs very well. The reason is that wheat germ agglutinin, not gluten, but the non-alcohol soluble component of wheat as an anti-nutrient. It's called WGA. And it's not unique. There's similar things are found in kidney beans and soybeans that are anti-nutrients. When these lectins, as they're collectively called, bind on to other proteins in your diet, they make you allergic to the egg protein, but it wasn't the egg's fault. It was the wheat germ agglutinin, or WGA's fault. There's some fascinating examples of how wheat germ agglutinins, phytohemoagglutinins found in many of your beans and lentils, how they turn on autoimmunity. It's really fascinating. You know, red meat has for years now been beaten up and, you know, villainized by so many researchers and health professionals. But when you really compare the effects on physiology of, let's say, a modest amount of red meat cooked in liquid, so it's not forming harmful byproducts of the cooking process, compared to some type of legume that was less cooked and maybe not soaked or fermented as it would be traditionally used in India, for instance, you can't begin to compare the negative effects that would be produced by the bean, or in the case of wheat, the grain, to the meat, which is far more compatible with human physiology. So again, much like we've talked about with sunlight and with cholesterol and all of these different topics, it's no less shocking to hear that many meats, again, and I think it's critical that we always give gratitude and reverence to that animal, which is nourishing us with its own life. You know, that's, I think, a very critical part of the process. That being said, meat and eggs and many dairy products are so much more compatible with human physiology than many plant foods, which have been given a pass because they're part of a plant-based diet, yet they're not very compatible with who we are. So with that, I'm going to get a drink of water, but I'd love to answer any questions you have. Am I going to be talking about fruit? A lot. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Thanks a lot. So your question is a really common one. Am I going to talk about fruit? Isn't fruit great to eat large quantities of? And bananas, a good source of potassium. On a scale of 1 to 10, and I say this at least once a week in one way or another, either to a person I'm working with or, you know, in a talk that maybe someone like Mark and I are having. On a scale of 1 to 10, a banana is about a 3 when it comes to potassium. The spinach is a 10. The dandelion greens are a 10.5. Tomatoes are phenomenal. I love tomatoes. I tend to look at fruit this way. What are the upsides of the fruit and what are the downsides? The downside to many fruits are the fructose content. Fructose is a very unique type of sugar that depletes the liver. It depletes our body of many things. Glucose is very different. So when you look at a tomato, tomatoes are very low fructose and very high potassium. I think tomatoes are phenomenal. I think tomatoes are one of the best fruits you can eat. Right there with berries, star fruits, tangerines. These are good fruits because they're very low fructose and high potassium. Now, the contrast to those would be bananas. High fructose, low potassium in relationship to that, right? Apples, they're okay when they're in season, but you don't want to eat too many of them. Higher fructose, especially if you're getting the giant red apples that are grown in like Washington State. Small heirloom varieties of apples that are very sour, not very sweet. That's a different, you know, different fruit. There's more room for those. But, you know, I was always amazed by, especially in Asia, people didn't eat that much fruit. And I said, wow. And they're like, no, we don't eat that much fruit. Fruit's only in season for a short period of time and everything's competing for it. And then when you start to think about what plants do to help spread them through the environment, fructose is interesting because, see, fructose is something that fruits have to lure everything from the toucan to the monkey to the tapir. And then what happens when animals eat too much fruit? Whether you're a human or a toucan, all of that fructose makes the seeds go through you very rapidly. And it's called endotoxemia if you're looking at digestive distress caused by eating too much dried fruit, right? You eat a box of raisins, what happens, right? You eat a box of raisins, you get diarrhea, right? And people always say to me, yeah, I ate too much fiber. I'm like, it wasn't the fiber. There's not that much fiber in a box of raisins, but there's about 50 grams of fructose. When you go beyond 25 grams of fructose, you're going to have really loose stools. And when you hit 50 grams of fructose, you're probably going to have at least one episode of diarrhea. That's perfect for the grape. Because now you get those grape seeds, right, out in the soil, and they're fertilized. Just like we talked about with cereal grains. Does that make sense? So when I look at fruit, I think the best fruits are berries and those with very low levels of fructose but have major upsides like polyphenolics in the berries or the potassium in the tomato. So, but I think fruit is something to eat just to keep it in moderation. You know, I don't think fruit should be more than like 5 to 10% of our diet. As opposed to, in the United States, I meet a lot of people who are vegans and half of their diet is fruit. Fruit smoothies and fruit salads, and they're not feeling well. I think fruit has to be a small percentage, and vegetables have to be a much greater percentage.
Yeah. You said tangerines, tomatoes,
star fruit.
Avocados,
right. Yeah. Coconuts. Coconuts are a nut. They're actually a member of the drupe family, like dates. And, you know, coconuts are a phenomenal example of how you can look at a plant. Am I over my time here? 1 minute. So in summary, past 1 minute. So I can finish this up later. plenty of time later this week. But the low fructose fruits, remind me to talk about how you can look at a fruit, how you can look at plants and kind of get a sense for what's going on. The best fruits to eat are going to be tomatoes, berries, tangerines, star fruit. Grapefruits are really good. There's only about 4 grams of fructose in a big grapefruit. There's 11 grams of fructose in a big banana. And most people need to limit their fructose to 10 grams per meal, 25 grams per day. So, you know, if you had a cup of tomatoes, you're fine. You have a cup of berries, you're fine. You have a banana, you started to use up most of your fructose allotment for the day. And there's some really cool stuff that's been done on this by people like Paul Stanhope and Robert Lustig on fructose. I look at fructose as Paracelsus, I'm going to finish with this. Paracelsus had this amazing rule. At every point, something becomes a toxin. Something can be a medicine at a very small dose, and then you have too much of it, and it's a toxin. And I think that's the case with fruit. I think a little bit of fruit is great medicine, but too much fruit, you're starting to create an imbalance in the body. All right, well, thank you. Thanks.